we talk a little bit more about warped extra dimensions. And recall that this is what we're going to take as our background space, a five-dimensional setup, where the fifth dimension is warped in the sense that there's a relative scale factor here relative to your fifth coordinate. And we can do a change of variables and change the fifth coordinate variable such that this turns into a power law. So very roughly, this z corresponds to a log of w. And the nice thing about this is that if we put the Higgs on the so-called IR brain, the natural scale for any mass parameters on the IR brain is warped down to a factor like this relative to fundamental scales. So in this setup, we also have m star on the order of k on the order of m Planck, where k is this k here. And in a sense, it measures the curvature of the fifth dimension. So we have this setup. But the Higgs effective parameter, the mu f for the Higgs on the IR brain, ends up coming out to be something on the order of whatever natural value it has in the original action times e to the minus k pi r. So if we have a modest hierarchy where this pi r, where kr is on the order of 11, because it gets exponentiated with a pi, we can warp down something that's near the Planck scale down to near the TEV scale. And this is the nice feature of these RS theories. So they give a solution to the hierarchy problem through the geometry. And what's happening effectively is that we'll see in a second that gravity is in some sense localized away from the IR. And this means that the force of gravity that we see is reduced, is a lot less than what the fundamental scale is. Okay. So I'm going to come back to the graviton. I'm going to come back later on to look at gravitons in the five-dimensional part. The terminology is that we call this full five-dimensional space the bulk. And we call these boundaries brains. And what we're going to do as a warm-up before doing gravitons is look at a gauge field traveling in the bulk. And let me say in passing that there are a lot of ways to embed the standard model in theories like this. The original RS idea was to have the Higgs plus all the standard model fields on the IR brain. And then you only have gravity in the bulk. In this case, you can expand the graviton field and get KK modes out. And those are your new particles, the KK modes. More recently, though, people have started putting some of the standard model fields in the bulk as well. And I'll talk about putting a vector field in the bulk. You can also put a fermion in the bulk. And that has some interesting effects. One of the interesting effects is it can give you a nice story for flavor, for why the Yukawa couplings are all very different. And those very different Yukawa couplings can come about from, if you like, localization of the fermions in the extra dimension. And depending on how much overlap they have with the Higgs, you can get larger or smaller Yukawa couplings. In any case, let me start off by looking at a vector boson a 5D vector boson traveling in the bulk space. So I'm going to use the z coordinate because it ends up being more convenient. And I'm going to assume Neumann boundary conditions. Which is specifically that del z am at z equals L0, L1 is equal to 0. So recall in these z coordinates, this IR brain corresponds to z equals L0 equals inverse k. And this is z equals L1, which is much, much bigger than L0. So we're going to look at a vector field with Neumann boundary conditions. And the action for this field, so for now I'll just do a U1 gauge field, is the essentially just what you'd expect it to be. With a minus one quarter up front. So the action is, of course, you just integrate over everything. Because we're including space-time curvature, you have to include this factor of the determinant of the metric. And you take the square root. And this is to give you, if you like, a coordinate invariant measure. For the gauge field strengths, these are just the usual. Field strength tensors. For these objects, we have to contract them up with a metric, or I should say the inverse metric. So the inverse metric, you have to be a little bit careful. The inverse metric is, in this case, is not the same as a metric. In this case, the inverse metric is going to be essentially the same thing here, but with this factor flipped. So if I take GMN, GMN with lower and upper indices, this factor cancels out. So this is my action. And right off the bat, just like in four dimensions, you can see that there's a gauge invariance. And the gauge invariance is that AM goes to AM minus 1 over E del M alpha. But now alpha can depend also on the extra dimensional coordinate. And one nice choice we can make using this freedom that's consistent with the Neumann boundary conditions is that we can choose alpha such that A5 is equal to 0. So this is a this is just a choice of gauge, but it's one that was going to simplify our life. OK, so we'll take the setup. And what we're going to do is, just like we did in flat space and just like you did in the tutorial, we're going to expand these vectors in KK modes and try to recast this theory as a tower of four-dimensional states. So let me just scooch this up. So let me mention now that if I set A5 is equal to AZ. So if that wasn't clear, and now let me warn you that Z is the extra dimensional coordinate, not the last spatial coordinate. So there's a bit of an abusive notation, but in any case, so we have this, and one implication of this result is that the components of FMN that are non-zero are now F mu nu, and F mu z, which is just equal to minus del z a mu, because there's no a z component. And there's no f z z component no matter what, because f mu nu or fmn is anti-symmetric already. So I have my four-dimensional field strength, and then I have something that looks like the derivative of a vector. Okay, so what I do at this point, I can do a bunch of things at this point, but I'm going to rewrite my action in a helpful way. And that is, so first of all, if I look at the root metric part, the determinant of the metric is going to have 5 powers of L naught over Z, but then I take the square root, and I get rid of the squared on top. So what I end up with from the metric piece is L naught over Z to the fifth. And if I look at the GM, the two inverse metrics, that's going to give me 2 factors of Z over L naught. And I'll be left over with A to mu alpha, A to mu beta, F mu nu, F alpha beta, plus 2, A to mu alpha, F mu z, F alpha z. After taking my FMN, FMN, and only keeping the non-zero components. So I can simplify this further. This first piece is just my usual field strength tensor. Oh, and then, sorry, I forgot my minus 1/4. There's always a minus 1/4. I have a minus 1/4 up here. So for this piece, I have del mu a nu, del nu a mu. And these are just regular derivatives. And I can integrate by parts on this and do the usual recasting such that this thing looks like, have it right. One half a mu, mu nu del squared minus del mu del nu a nu. So this is just the usual rewriting of this that you get by integrating by parts. This form is handy for driving equations of motion. Because for the equations of motion, I just take dda, and that's going to get rid of this piece. Or it can act on this piece, for which I integrate by parts to move this onto here. So I just essentially just cancel off this and multiply by 2 for the equation of motion. So this form makes it easier to explicitly see the equation of motion through the variation principle. And for this part, what I end up with is a 1/2. A to mu nu, a mu, del z squared, minus 1 over z, del z, a nu. So here, these pieces are going to turn into just a dz a mu squared. So that's straightforward. But for one of these pieces, I'm going to take the dz and integrate by parts, which means that when I integrate by parts, I have to be careful that I have a z dependence over here. So when I integrate by parts, I'm going to get a dz acting on the other dz a mu, but multiplied by this. And that's where I get this extra factor of 1 over z. So again, I won't go through the steps, but it's straightforward to sit down, integrate by parts carefully, and see that you get this. OK, and along the way, to get rid of boundary terms here, in integrating by parts, I've used the Neumann boundary condition. And you can show that with the Neumann boundary condition, the boundary piece vanishes there. OK. And what we want to do is find a set of KK modes. And then we're going to find a set of KK modes. And we're going to find a set of orthonormal functions and expand A in terms of them, and then plug it back in and get out something that's hopefully fairly reasonable. So what I claim, and it's fairly easy to check, is that we're going to expand A mu of A and Z as sum over sum n a mu n of x fn of z. And the fn of z that's appropriate here should play nicely with this dependence here. And the fancy words we want is that this is, if you like, a Sturm-Liouville theorem, and you can show that this is a Hermitian operator on the space of functions, such that functions on this z coordinate on the interval, such that they satisfy Neumann boundary conditions. And because I have a Hermitian operator, its eigenmodes will be a complete set, and the distinct eigenvalues will be and eigenmodes with the distinct eigenvalues will be orthogonal. So this is what we're going to try to construct for this, these fn's. And what we want for the fn's specifically is dz squared minus 1 over z dz plus z squared mn squared. Actually, sorry, there's no z squared here. So in other words, this mn squared is going to correspond to the eigenvalue of this operator that matches up over here. And we're also going to want orthonormality, which is integral dz. In this case, it should be orthonormal with respect to this measure, and not over z. Fn, fm is equal to delta nm. So the idea of this is, if I have these functions, and these functions of z, and I plug them in here, well, first of all, this piece, this operator acting on the thing would just give me an mn squared. So I'll have something that's, it'll give me mn squared times fm fn, that when I integrate over dz, I use orthogonality to make the double sum into a single sum. And then in this piece, this operator just goes through the doesn't care about the z dependence, so I also use orthonormality to get the usual piece for each mode here. But now I get a mass term at each n level from this part. So this is what we want. And okay, let me shift up. When I go through this procedure, it turns out that after some fiddling, you can show that the fn of z are going to be given by some normalization factor, nn times z over L0, j1 fmnz plus beta n yn, sorry, y1 of mnz. So you can show that the eigenmodes are Bessel functions, J1 and Y1, up to an overall factor here. And if you recall from your probably some equation differential or some course in differential equations you took, or possibly some kind of mathematical physics course you may have taken at some point, the J's and Y's, the Bessel functions, are mutually orthogonal on the finite interval with Neumann boundary conditions. And this piece is going to cancel off this piece in the measure. So this is my set of basis functions. And I can expand my AMUs in terms of them. But we also have to apply boundary conditions. And our boundary conditions are that the derivative of A with respect to Z at each of the boundaries vanishes. And there happens to be a nice property of Bessel functions that if you take essentially x to the alpha times j, x to the alpha times j alpha of the x, when you take the derivative, you get back the Bessel function with one lower index here. So it turns out that the boundary conditions applied at two spots, beta n is minus and you can show that this is roughly equal to pi over 2 over gamma minus log mn L0 over 2, where this is the Euler gamma function, roughly 0.57. And so this is the boundary condition at L0. if I apply the boundary condition at L1, I get a similar thing. And now I get beta n is equal to minus J0 of mn L1 over Y0 of mn L1. So we have these two conditions, and we want to solve for we have these two conditions. So first of all, this fixes beta n in terms of the mass, these eigenvalues mn. But second of all, we also want to figure out what the possible mn values are. So to find out what these mn values are, we set this equal to this, and solve for whatever values of mn allow these two things to be equal. So this quantity, to a pretty good approximation, is fairly constant. I just have a log. Whereas the arguments of this function, end up being kind of order one-ish. And you can show that after some fiddling around, the solutions to a pretty good approximation are that the solutions to setting these equal correspond roughly to the zeros of J0. Let me also remind you that just the general feature of Bessel functions, at small arguments, for small argument, how does it go? The J1 goes linearly, and Y1 diverges as one over x. So J1 goes like x for small arguments. Y1 goes like 1 over x. And then going to larger arguments, they start to oscillate. And they oscillate with they oscillate out of phase with each other. So this y1 goes like 1 over root x sine x roughly. So that means that my mn's correspond to these zeros of what's approximately a cosine. And at least once you get past the first few eigenmodes, I get pi over L1. N minus 1/4. And so on and so forth. Now, these are the non-trivial modes with Mn non-zero. As Mn goes to zero, the Bessel function thing doesn't apply anymore. These guys don't work so well. But for M0, what you find is Fn of z is, we just end up solving, where are we? We end up solving del z squared minus 1 over z del z. So that means that I get f double prime minus 1 over z f prime. And a general solution is just linear. But when I apply Neumann boundary conditions, that forces this thing to go to zero. So my zero mode wave function is just a flat, it's just a constant. OK, so I have a flat zero mode wave function, and I have these oscillatory higher wave functions, and these are slightly more complicated than just the sines and cosines you would get in flat space, but it's still something fairly similar. So at the end of the day, your fn of z goes roughly like root z mn times oscillation So the general structure of the wave functions at the end of the day is I have something that is suppressed by a large log in the denominator. So recall that L1 is much, much bigger than L0. So this root z, as it approaches L1, ends up being much, much bigger than this. And this piece is small both because I have an L0 and also because I have an extra log suppression. So the form of these wave functions, and this is a general feature of KK modes, is I have my zero mode. So my zero mode is just flat across the extra dimension. But the KK modes are going to have some number of oscillations, but they're also going to start off being very suppressed. So these guys look essentially very small, very damped, and then with some Neumann boundary condition. So the upshot of the story is that, first of all, if I look at these, if I look at pi over L1, recall that L1, when I do my change of variables, 1 over L1 is roughly TeV, whereas 1 over L0 is roughly M Planck. So that means that my KK modes in this setup are spaced by a TeV, order TeV, and at least once past the first few modes, they're fairly evenly split. And the story here is, if we live on the IR brain, or at least the fermion part of us lives on the IR brain, we're going to see some fixed coupling to the zero mode, which is just flat and smeared across the extra dimension. Whereas for these, for the KK modes, we're going to have an enhanced coupling to the KK mode. So the way RS theories were kind of studied, or I guess the timeline is that the first thing people tried is just putting all the standard model on the IR brain. And that works reasonably well, but you don't have to do that. The second thing people tried is, okay, let's try putting gauge fields in the bulk as well and keep the fermions on the IR brain. The problem here, though, is that once you reproduce the regular gauge couplings, because the KK modes are localized towards the IR, you get a really big effective coupling to the KK modes. So even though their mass is about a TeV, you end up having a much larger coupling to them than you might naively expect. And what you end up getting out of that is the indirect constraints on these KK modes are really strong, and this idea doesn't really work. So the third thing people tried is going back and putting fermions into the bulk space as well. And there's a nice story there. I'm going to leave it for a second. I'm going to leave it for a second and talk a little bit about graviton KK modes. And I'll come back to fermions in a minute. Okay. So for graviton KK modes, you go through and do the same thing. You have to be a little bit more careful now because, well, your starting action is now the Einstein-Hilbert action. And what you do here is take that starting action with the fixed with this fixed background geometry and expand the small fluctuations around it. So you can have various kinds of fluctuations. If you remember back to what we had for in large extra dimensions, we found that when we had the standard model entirely on at a single point, with gravity traveling in all these extra dimensions, we typically had a bunch of extra vector modes and a bunch of extra scalar modes coming from decomposing the graviton. So these are vector modes and scalar modes that you get from looking at the higher dimensional HMN and decomposing it under four-dimensional Lorentz. What you get here, because we're in five dimensions, it turns out that at each KK level, when you apply general coordinate invariance with only one extra dimension, all of the extra vector modes you have are eaten by the graviton at each level. And what you're left with at the end of the day at each KK level is one h mu nu n, and and this is it, except there's one extra excitation. And that is, there's one extra zero mode scalar derived from the derived from the graviton field. And this thing we usually call a radion or a dilaton. And I'll talk a little bit about it in a second. But let me start off by talking about these h mu nu n's. For these h mu nu n's, what you get for their wave function profiles is some normalization factor times z over L0 squared J2 of MNZ plus beta N Y2 MNZ. So you go through the same procedure as we did for vectors. You have to carry around more metric factors, but now you get instead of a J2 instead of a J1 and a Z squared instead of a Z1. Where are we? So in this case, the masses correspond to zeros of MN of J1 of MN L1. And this goes roughly like pi over L1 n plus 1 half. And then you have some normalization factor that yada, yada, yada. Now, these guys, if I look at the structure, I have this, and then I have a zero mode, which ends up looking like. Okay, so I have these graviton KK modes. Again, the zero mode is flat. And being flat is nice because this means it's going to couple universally to everything. So no matter where I put any other fields and couple them to gravity, because this thing is flat, they'll feel the same effective strength of gravity. On the other hand, the KK modes, having this form with Z squared, J2, and Y2, are going to be localized towards the IR brain, and that means that these guys are going to have a stronger effect of coupling to us than the zero mode, and you can see that explicitly by coupling gravity to the standard model. So the standard model part of the action in general Okay, so actually I should say the standard model part of the action for on so for now let's just say I put the standard model on the IR brain. You can worry about more complicated things in a second. So here I just take my usual action. And I have my standard model action where I use the metric, the full metric g. But I also have to be careful that I project it onto the IR brain. So the projection onto the IR brain is just the delta here. And when I do this, and I expand out the graviton excitation coming from here and here, what I get is a set of effective couplings. And that set of effective couplings looks like d4x minus 1 over m Planck times I have my energy momentum tensor of the standard model multiplying the zero mode graviton. This effective coupling. Looks like this. So the coupling I get out of this between the graviton modes and us, we have the usual gravity story. But this piece, this L1, is enhanced. And this L1 goes, if you call something that goes roughly like 1 over TeV. So the coupling between us and the graviton KK modes, instead of being 1 over M Planck suppressed, is now 1 over TeV suppressed. And this means that these operators that connect the standard model to gravitons are not all that small anymore. And because of that, there's a hope that by colliding standard model particles, let's say in the LHC, I can start to create these KK gravitons. And in this case, the KK gravitons have masses on the order of a TeV. And I could see them as individual resonances. So for example, I could have a process, let's say E plus, E minus, where I produce, let's say, the first KK mode. And then this guy decays into stuff that I see. So let's say U plus mu minus. So the way you can look for these KK gravitons, and actually this story also applies to KK vectors, is you collide standard model particles, and you look for pairs of particles whose invariant mass reconstructs the mass of this state. So what you would expect for, let's say, sigma of root s, as a function of root s, where root s is the center of mass energy for the initial collision, is you have the usual standard model stuff. It kind of looks like this. But when you start producing the KK modes, you can get other resonances from these guys. So the first resonances tend to be pretty spiky. And the second and later resonances kind of blur out. And they're roughly evenly spaced. So this is a signal of this kind of warped extra dimension you can look for at the LHC, and it's been looked for. And we have limits on the order of a few TeV on the masses of this kind of KK excitation. Now, there's one other piece that I didn't mention. The piece that I didn't mention is this radion field. So the radion field, in this setup, if I don't do anything else, corresponds to a zero mode and just ends up being exactly massless. It's massless and it couples to the energy momentum tensor as 1 over m Planck, t mu mu, r of x. So we have a massless scalar, and as usual, having new massless particles coupling to the standard model is a problem. So this radion, being massless, could travel long distances, and it couples to the standard model, specifically the trace of the energy momentum transfer. And and this could, for example, give you corrections to the effective gravitational force. So the so-called fifth force picture that is very strongly constrained. So we'd also like to figure out a way to make the radion heavy. And it turns out that the masslessness of this radion corresponds to the fact that the original geometry we wrote down isn't entirely stable, in the sense that you can show that this bulk solution, this bulk picture, this warped geometry, solves Einstein equations, provided you put in a bulk cosmological constant and you put tensions on the brains. But if you look at the potential for fluctuations around that configuration, you find that there's nothing that's unstable, but there's a flat direction in the potential. And the flat direction of the potential corresponds to moving the brains closer together or farther apart. And that flat direction, that idea of moving the brains closer or farther apart, coincides with having this massless particle, the radion. If you like, the radion is parameterizing, the radion is parameterizing the, or is a fluctuation around a VEV that parameterizes the size of the extra dimension. So there are ways to stabilize the radion. One of the most popular, is at least in a field theory picture, is Goldberger-Wise. And this turns out to match up with certain fancier string theory constructions and certain limits. But in any case, there's a way to make the radion massive. And this has the effect of stabilizing this bulk space. And in particular, it can stabilize it with a mild hierarchy between the size of the bulk and the curvature. So we need a mild hierarchy to get this KR of roughly 11 to get enough warping. So that's all under control. And because we're able to stabilize the radion without doing much damage to the rest of the story, I'll just assume that the radion has been stabilized and isn't massless anymore, and so on and so forth. OK, so as I was saying before, the first thing people tried is putting the standard model on the IR brain. And with the standard model on the IR brain, you get something that works. But the only new thing to see are graviton KK modes. And you can look for them this way. The next thing people tried is putting gauge fields in the bulk. And there you get a story like this. And it turns out it's ruled out because these KK modes couple very strongly to stuff on the IR brain because of the localization, and you get very strong constraints from indirect stuff, so things like flavor or precision electroweak. So actually, precision electroweak especially. So the third thing people tried, and this gives a nice story, is put SM fermions in the bulk. So it turns out that for fermions, there are a few complications. The first thing with fermions is that if you put a fermion into five dimensions, this way, in five dimensions, what would be gamma five in four dimensions now becomes one of the gamma matrices. And with this, you have gamma A, gamma B, equals 2 eta AB. And this gives this gives a so-called Clifford algebra. And you find that the upshot is you find that your fermion representations for 5D Lorentz locally end up being two-component Dirac fermions. So the smallest representation The smallest representation are four-component Dirac fermions. But what we want in four dimensions is a pair of chiral fermions, psi left, psi right. Now we have this. We also know that we have to impose boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are going to relate the left and right-handed pieces here. And what I mean by this is, suppose I write my psi L of x of z and phi right of x of z as sum on n fn L of z psi n L of x. So I do my usual KK mode expansions, but I try different KK mode expansions for left and right. What you end up coming up with is the equations of motion, the KK equations you want. End up having a form that looks something like this. So it turns out that if you go through the same procedure of integrating by parts and writing down the kinetic term, you get a KK mode piece that looks like this, where the c minus 2 over z comes from putting in a term like m psi bar psi in the action and writing m as c over L0. So the c here corresponds to a value of a bulk mass term. And the thing that the problem that ends up happening is that if I try to impose just pure, if I try to impose boundary conditions for both fn and fnl and fnr, if I impose, for example, Neumann for both, or Dirichlet for both, it turns out that I don't get a zero mode at all. And in these cases, the zero mode corresponds to setting this equal to zero. So this is a problem, but it turns out that by choosing different boundary conditions for the left and right-handed guys, I can project out, I can get a zero mode for one, but no zero mode for the other. So what we usually do is we say plus corresponds to Neumann, and minus corresponds to Dirichlet. And if you choose plus for psi left and minus for psi right, you end up with only a zero mode for psi left. And if you do it the other way around, minus for psi left, plus for psi right, you only get a zero mode for psi right. So you can use this to take these Dirac fermions and to get zero modes that are chiral, whereas the rest of the KK towers are going to be non-chiral. But in any case, because we only need to reproduce at the chiral level the standard model, this is all we need. The other thing you get out of this when you look at zero modes is that the zero modes are turn out to be exponentials. You'll work this out in the last homework. And these zero modes are either peaked towards the UV or they're peaked towards the IR. So we put the Higgs here. So first of all, we can get chiral fermions or chiral fermion zero modes by localization. And the amount of localization is set by the value of this C thing. So for every fermion, for every five-dimensional Dirac fermion, I set some C, and that determines the localization of the zero mode, as you'll find. Now, because I'm either exponentially localized towards the IR or towards the UV, what ends up happening is that when I write down a Higgs, when I write down an effective Higgs coupling between two fermions in the bulk connecting to the Higgs on the IR brain, it's going to have a delta Z minus L1. This delta means that I have to project the fermion wave functions onto the IR brain. And when I project the fermion wave functions onto the IR brain, that means that the more overlap I have, the more wave function weight I have, the larger the effective Yukawa coupling is going to be after I also include this. So this is a nice story because it lets us get very different Yukawa couplings with only order one changes in the C parameter. So all of our bulk masses are still on the order of the natural scale L0, or 1 over L0. But we only have to vary our C parameter a little bit to get very, very different effective Yukawa couplings. So this is a nice feature. And you'll get to explore this a little bit more in the homework. So the last thing I wanted to talk about, I don't have much time, but and it's going to have to be a little hand-wavy, but it's sort of a nice story. And the last topic I want to talk about is this idea of warping and theories of strong coupling. And the argument is that in a sense, the warping here is going to look like a renormalization group running. And the idea is there's going to be a correspondence of the UV brain corresponding to some heavy input scale, let's say the Planck scale. And as you go to, as you move through the fifth dimension towards the IR brain, that this is in a sense equivalent to renormalization group running in a four-dimensional field theory. And finally, when you hit the IR brain, something happens to the renormalization group running, and we'll get to that in a second. So this picture of the five-dimensional warping corresponding to renormalization group running is a, if you like, very non-rigorous, extrapolation of the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. So ADS-CFT originally comes from string theory, where it was noticed that a certain kind of string theory, so-called type 2B, on a certain geometry, ADS-5 cross S-5, was in a sense equivalent, and the technical term is dual, to n equals 4 So this goes back to the mid-90s, but it was a really interesting and I feel like somewhat surprising discovery that there was a way in which this string theory, which if you like is being treated as a theory of gravity, it has spin two graviton modes in it. This string theory, the stuff you compute in the string theory can be matched up to stuff you would compute in this SUN gauge theory. So n equals 4 means that I have four independent supersymmetry generators. SUN just means it's you take an SUN gauge theory, and then you expand it such that it's consistent with n equals 4 supersymmetry. And it's a pure gauge theory in the sense that the corresponding non-supersymmetric version would just be the theory of an SUN gluon. When you supersymmetrize it with n equals 1, you need a gluino. And n equals 4 leads to more things. So this correspondence has been studied in a lot of detail. There's no rigorous proof, but people have checked it enough that I'd say most people are pretty convinced that it's right. And some of the things that match up, so for example, are if I look at the geometric symmetries of the S5 state, these can be matched onto onto a certain R symmetry, in this case an SU4 R symmetry of this underlying gauge theory. And it turns out these S5A symmetries correspond to an SO6, which turns out to be the same as an SU4. There's also a set of, if you like, geometric isometries of ADS-5, and this turns out to correspond to the 4D conformal group. And on this side, it turns out that this is a this is a conformal field theory. So there's also another matching here, And I'll come back to this conformal idea in a second. And finally, the parameters of this theory, there is a radius, a curvature radius associated with the ADS space. And the curvature radius over the fourth divided by LS to the fourth. And LS is, if you like, a string scale. So 1 over LS is kind of a characteristic mass scale for string excitations. This matches up with the combination 4 pi g squared n, where g squared is a gauge coupling, and n is this n, not that n. Okay, so I'll call this n tilde just to distinguish it. So the interesting thing is that this is a string theory with all the string excitations and gravity and so on. This is just a four-dimensional gauge theory without gravity. And it seems very surprising that a quantum theory with gravity can match up to a quantum theory without gravity, for one thing. Another thing that's interesting is that there's a limit in which this string theory can be written as an effective field theory of essentially an effective field theory with supergravity. So this is a string theory. It has a lot of supersymmetry built in. And if you take the low energy limit, where the string excitations are, in a sense, heavy, you can integrate them out. And the low energy effective theory you get out of that is essentially a supergravity theory. And that supergravity theory corresponds to this thing. The supergravity limit corresponds to this thing being this quantity being pretty big. So in other words, when this is big, the ADS radius is big compared to the string scale. And that means that, in some sense, the ADS 5 space is kind of big compared to the fundamental scale. And in that limit, it turns out you can ignore the string excitations. And this is big. And that means that this is just a theory of supergravity. And I match it up on this side to something that's also big. And that means that my theory of supergravity, now, on this side, it's still just an effective field theory, but it's one that I have control over. This theory of supergravity is matching on to the gauge theory at strong coupling. So the supergravity limit corresponds to this thing being big, which corresponds to this thing being big, which corresponds to the gauge theory being strongly coupled. So this is neat because because we have a lot of control over the string theory in the supergravity limit, but we don't have that much control over the gauge theory in the strong coupling limit. So, so kind of two surprising results of this are that we're able to match up a theory with quantum gravity to a theory without gravity, a quantum theory without gravity. And second of all, the easy calculational limit of this corresponds to the hard calculational limit of that. And this is where this idea of so-called dualities is really useful and important. That if you're able to describe the same physics using two different descriptions, and one of those descriptions is weakly coupled and the other is strongly coupled, then it's much, much easier to use the weakly coupled one than the strongly coupled one. So these are all the nice features of so-called ADS CFD, specifically in this case. And this idea has been generalized, not necessarily all that rigorously, but this picture, if you start not worrying about the details too much, starts to end up looking a little bit like our work fifth dimension. So ADS 5 space is a five-dimensional ADS space, which turns out to be exactly this geometry, at least this geometry where I take the brains off to infinity. This S5, in the stringy picture, the S5 is a compact space. And in this limit, this S5 gets very, very small. So in this sort of strong coupling limit, this thing looks like, if you like, a large, or I should say an infinite ADS space, with an S5 being compactified in a very small way. So in the low energy limit, you won't see the S5. And from the hand-wavy interpretation in terms of these 5D warp models, the UV brain includes stuff like the S5 compactified on it and just crunched down. Whereas the ADS part is the stretched fifth dimension. Okay. So I just want to say a few more things. So there are two more places where this 5D picture seriously diverges from here, but there's still an interpretation within this language. So I should say that there is a, I don't know, I'd say but correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but there's kind of a general feeling in this field that this should be some very deep thing that's very general, much well beyond this the simple case. So the idea here is this fifth dimension should be essentially a toy picture of something that looks a little bit like this. But the difference is that we have these brains at finite spaces. Whereas in the original 2B ADS5 cross S5, it looks like we've taken the brains off to infinity. So the interpretation is UV brain sorry if you can't read that, but the UV brain is interpreted on the gauge theory side as an explicit breaking of conformal symmetry in the UV. So we're going to try to use a hand-wavy ADS5 based on this intuition. And the argument is that this finite slice of ADS5 with the UV brain, we're going to connect this to a non-supersymmetric four-dimensional strongly coupled field theory. In the four-dimensional strongly coupled field theory, the UV brain coincides with an explicit conformal breaking in the UV. So to give you an explicit example of this, suppose I look at QCD, or QCD-like theory, with a bunch of massless quarks. And one so you can show that QCD, when you only have massless quarks, is classically scale invariant. And what I mean by this is that suppose I do a scaling of x to lambda inverse of x, q goes to lambda 3 halves q, and g mu goes to lambda g mu. If I rescale by all these things and I don't have any mass terms, it turns out that the action for QCD, or at least the classical action, is invariant under these transformations. And these transformations just correspond to a rescaling by the naive mass dimension. Now, if I put in a mass term will turn out to break this. But the story here is that suppose I break conformal, oh, sorry. So this is classical conformal, classical scale invariance. But I also have a breaking at the quantum level from the fact that my d alpha s dt has a non-trivial scale dependence. And this BQCD, if you recall, is 11/3 n minus 2/3 the number of flavors. But as far as the number of flavors go, you only keep light flavors. So I'll finish in a second. But the point is, if I have this picture of NF massive quarks and one flavor massive Q, suppose I arrange for 11/3 N minus 2/3 NF to go to 0. In this case, if I'm below the mass of the heavy quark, the theory should look approximately conformal. But if I'm above the mass of the heavy quark, I'll have a non-zero beta function, and I won't have conformal anymore. So the picture here is this is kind of a toy model for this kind of explicit UV breaking, that I have some UV scale where I flow into a conformal field theory. And now between the UV brain and the IR brain, I flow through the normalization group within my conformal field theory. And then the IR brain is interpreted as a spontaneous breaking of the conformal symmetry. And this can happen, for example, if you have some operator in the theory that starts off very small and grows and grows and grows and suddenly becomes important enough that it kicks you out of the conformal regime. Now, the story of on the gauge theory side of a spontaneous breaking of conformal means that because I'm spontaneously breaking conformal, I have I expect a Goldstone boson, so I expect a massless scalar, and that massless scalar actually can be matched onto the massless radion in the RS theory. So we get rid of this massless Nambu-Goldstone boson by putting in a small explicit breaking of a conformal in the gauge theory side, and that's morally equivalent in this picture to the breaking of to putting stuff something into a stabilizer radion. So just one last comment. This picture of warped RS series, where you have a approximately conformal field theory down to near the TV scale and then kicks out, the interpretation of having a Higgs on the IR brain is the stuff that's localized towards the IR is interpreted as bound states of the approximately conformal field theory that's kicked out of the conformal regime. So when you're kicked out of the conformal regime, the gauge theory can run strong. And when it runs strong, you get confinement and bound states and so on. So if you go back and think about strong coupling, when we had this, we had technicolor, and extended technicolor, and walking technicolor, we were able to say some general things there. But because the theories were typically strongly coupled, we weren't able to make specific predictions. With this picture, the interpretation is that we make these computations in five dimensions. And these things should match on to some walking technicolor theory that we don't necessarily know what it is in terms of just a four-dimensional field theory. So this is a really neat idea. And it's actually useful computationally as well, because we're able, if you like, to compute stuff for these what we think are walking technicolor theories by doing these calculations in five dimensions that are weakly coupled. And again, this, if you like, is a very hand-wavy extension of ADS-CFT, but it ends up being interesting, useful. So I better wrap it up there. I've gone a bit overboard, but I hope everyone's gotten something out of the course. You have one more homework that should be posted pretty soon. And if you have any questions about it, send me an email. So.